He's willing and ready to share if all you shut up and sit down. Let's introduce Charles.
Hi, everybody. I am Charles Derion, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm very grateful to be an alcoholic. And as I've said many times, that if I had my chances to live over, that I would do the same identical thing. To become an alcoholic, I wouldn't change one identical thing. Because Alcoholic Anonymous has brought me to where I am today, and if I hadn't been an alcoholic, I wouldn't have had the chance to come to 12th or O. We have to be careful about that anonymity. I'm very proud that the wonderful chairman of this conference decided to go into the barrel of speakers and come up with me. So no matter how it came about, I'm grateful to Tulsa for inviting me here. I'm grateful for all of the committees that supported them and got the approval to bring me here. Basically, I'm here to disclose my story in a general way, what I used to be like, what happened and what I'm like now. And I can tell you in a very few words what I used to be like. I used to be a horrible example. But any time that I stand before a group of people like you, I feel just like a retarded goat leading a herd of sheep. I don't know what to put about that. And I also feel like the old maid who said she felt bad even when she felt good because tomorrow she knew she was going to feel worse. Well, if I'd like to tell you about what I believe in alcoholism, I've been around the program. I'm entering my 15th year of sobriety. And I got sober the first meeting I went to, and I haven't found it necessary to drink thereafter. But I've heard a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous where people say that they were born alcoholics. Well, I was not born an alcoholic. And to prove that I was unique from these people, I went to my doctor that delivered me on my birth and asked him, how was I when I was delivered? And he said, Charlie, you were born cold sober, didn't have one trace of beer, wine, whiskey, or gin on your breath. So, I wasn't born an alcoholic. You know, I was coming around AA and I stuck around for 7 weeks and someone asked a stupid question, Charlie, do your kind become alcoholic? I wish Dave A would hear, you know, he's my friend, but I happen to be half Jew and half Negro. And this never bothered me for one time in my life, and this is when I was taking genetics in school and found out that the XY gene dominates the Y gene or vice versa, and this is the deciding factor whether you're going to be a boy or girl. And looking at this type of arithmetic, I knew good and well that what I had been taught about mathematics wasn't so in my home about this 50-50 deal. But having a mathematical mind, I decided maybe I'm 49% Jew and 51% Negro. And in making this wonderful analysis, I wouldn't expose it to my co-students because I had analyzed them a long time ago and found out that they belonged in the retarded, kindergarten for the retarded. So I went to my dad and I asked him, I said, Dad, am I 49% Jew and 51% Negro or vice versa? Naturally, him being to my illiterate, he said, what difference does it make? And I said, it makes a hell of a lot of difference. He said, like what? I said, if a little boy down the street wants to sell his bicycle for $20, and I don't know whether to jam down or go back tonight and steal it. Now I can see how come they ask, how do your kind become alcoholic? The next thing is that my concept of alcoholism, I've heard of Dr. Bell, and I've heard of Dr. Debenick, and I've heard of Dr. Block, and I've heard of Marty Mann. And none of these concepts fit me. Well, I'm going to tell you what my concept is. My concept of alcoholism is, alcoholism is a system of adultery perpetuated by an intimate relationship between sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity. I don't know the definition of that yet, but I've been sober trying to find out. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. First, I would like to give you a briefing of what I used to be like. I have many friends here in this room tonight that I've shared with, and they have caused this growth that I have achieved up to this point. So the only obstruction in my appearing before you is that they put a time limit on me speaking here today. See, any time that I have a chance to speak, I tell the people to put up the calendar. You know, we don't need no watches, you know. Put up the calendar and we'll be here a while. But to let you know that alcoholism have no respect of personal hit, I happen to come from a middle-class family who was able to provide me with the things that I wanted and needed. And I was the only child at one time, and my mother lavished me with many things that I didn't need. And I became very disturbed over this very early in life, because my people believed in political action, they believed in community services, they believed in religion, and they believed in qualified education, and they made every preparation they possibly could to prepare the children for these things. My mother was a fanatical religious woman, and she did not believe in playing marbles. She didn't believe in playing cards. So therefore, we became very unique kids in the community that I lived in. And these type of things, being isolated from the community, I decided that maybe I should find out what the other side of the world is doing. And for me to do this, I would have to give up all of these advantages that my mother and father had arranged for us. Well, I did. At the age of 16, it was just impossible for me to live with my mother and father. So I decided that I would leave home. And I left home and I come in contact with other middle-class people. And they had the same ideas that my mother and father had, exclusive of one thing, and that is that they would take a drink. And all that my mother and father had told us about the evils of drinking, I found out that they were not telling the truth. When I was amid those people, I found out that when they had a couple of drinks, their attitude changed. You know, they come out of the little secret room popping their fingers and shaking their legs, you know. And man, I wanted my attitude changed real bad at this point, you know. They don't know nothing about a billion, so I decided to have my first drink. And taking my first drink, this was the best thing that ever happened to me. When I had me a couple of shots of alcohol, for the first time in my life, I was able to express myself to people. And I resolved at that point that on every social function, I would always have me something to drink. So I learned about the flashes real quick. I never had a problem with alcohol for 5 years, because at the age of 16, I enjoyed this so well until I developed a dream that when I become 21, I won't have to adhere to nothing that my mother and father say. So I began to dream at 16, or coming 21 years old, and I won't have to depend on nobody. Well, August the 5th, 1940, I turned 21 years of age, and I felt just like Mickey Rooney when he said, "Today I am a man." And one of the great South celebrations came about. I didn't have enough money to buy whiskey, but we had that good old California muscatel wine, and boy, we was having a good time. 1 month and 10 days later, Hitler, Pedro, and Joseph Stalin, and President Roosevelt decided that we had an international emergency. Therefore, Roosevelt issued an executive order that every man to become 21 years of age up to 35 would have to enlist in the draft. And I hated this. I knew something was going to happen because I didn't want no parts along the Sam's Army, especially when you are paying $21 a month. At that time, I had developed the habit of, like one of my friends from Tennessee said, commingling, and I had learned how to steal, connive, con, and all of that, and I could steal more than that in one night. So I didn't need to go in Uncle Sam's Army, and I let them know about this. Well, I couldn't get out of it, and on May the 16th, 1941, Charlie became a soldier. I went in the reception center drunk. And this was a new turning point for Charlie. In Uncle Sam's Army, I stayed 4.5 years. And believe it or not, I'm not exaggerating one bit. Half of that time is guardhouse time. And I'll just give you the highlights of it. I had 3 general court-martials. Anyone being in Uncle Sam's Army knows that if you go for a general court-martial, you're subject to death, or is the court-martial made direct. With my alcohol, this didn't bother me one bit. And I had conditioned myself that I would rather be in Leavenworth, Kansas than to be in Uncle Sam's Army. I came out of Uncle Sam's Army with a rotten attitude, and I said that everybody's going to pay who supported Roosevelt and his ideas. And I started doing everything against the law, municipal laws, county, city, federal laws. And at one time, I thought I had it made. For the rest of my life, I'm going to become the first black millionaire in Georgia. Then I knew good and well that as smart as I was, that 2 people like Al Capone in Louisiana, I was going to put them out of business. And I had it made for a long time there, so one day in 1953, I'd come acquainted with a new man that I had never seen before. And he asked for Charles Berrien, and I answered to him. And he didn't answer me, he didn't tell me who he was. But he pulled his lapel back, and I found out that he was on the staff with J. Edgar Hoover. And for the first time in my life, I heard my life story. That man told me everything that I had ever done and how I did it and all of that, and told me if I didn't stop at this point, then they had a way of putting you away. Well, I didn't like that idea of being put away, because if any of you have been to Georgia, don't care whether it was a municipal case, county, city, or federal case, you end up on the chain gang. And on the chain gang in Georgia, they have some very conspicuous suits there. Black and white, horizontal, you know, 4 inches apart. And you can see a man 10 miles of that thing on, you know. Well, I like to be conspicuous, but not that conspicuous. So I had to make a decision, and the only decision that I knew to make at that time was God designed this earth like he wanted it, and it wasn't no use me going down there with no picks and shovels just picking the earth. You know. As a result of this, I decided to make a geographical change. And the only geography I knew of was to come to Flint, Michigan, where my sister lives, who is a carbon copy of my mother. I arrived in Flint on August the 28th, 1953. And that afternoon, having approximately $1,300 in my pocket and telling my sister that I was destitute, I didn't have enough money to buy cigarettes, she preached the first sermon I ever heard in my life. completely. And she's not ordained minister. She took me from Genesis to Revelation. And without a drink. And I went up there, and at the doctor gave that sermon, she said, Charlie, you need to get a job because you have been a disgrace to the Berean family. Well, naturally, I agreed with her because I'm going to stay with this girl, my sister, and her husband's going to pay the room and board for me. And I just ain't going to pay my sister no $20 or $25 a week for room and board. I've done her favor through the years, so it's time for her to do me a favor. But you know, she had a 260-pound henpecked husband. And my sister was a very domineering type of person, and any time she cracked a quit, he jumped. Well, he jumped the wrong way that next day, because the next day he took me out to Chevrolet Manufacturing Company and saw to me going into the personnel building, signing up for a job. Well, here I am at the age of 34, and I have never done no manual labor in my life, and I'm not about to start now. But somehow or another, the ball bounced the wrong way, because that afternoon at 3:30, Charlie had committed the greatest sin he ever committed in his life. I was punching a card. And I hated work. And I had told people for 34 years that I can leave aside a job all day, and as long as the job didn't job me, I wouldn't job the job. But here I am sweating for a living, and I just don't like it, and I just hate work. So I went up there, and I worked, and within the first hour, I decided I would quit. And then I began to think, Charlie, you have told people all your life that if you ended up on the Sahara Desert, you would always be able to make it. So you cannot go back home as a failure. So I worked for 3 weeks with my resentment to work. And after about the third week, I was running short of money, and I decided to cash a check. And I looked at my check, and I found out that 18% of my money was taken without my consent. I made some inquiries. And I found out for the first time in my life that poor people paid income tax. I didn't know poor people paid income tax. Well, at this point, I had all my life said that I would never get married. And the reason for me not getting married, I looked at my dad and I looked at my granddad, two timid, meek men, and married those two naggy, bitchy women now, you know, my mother and my grandmother. And I know that a man must have a hole in his head to resolve that he would live through sickness, death, up until death. You know, that man got a hole in his head to do that. And I found out here that how come women live longer than men? Women don't live with women. But if a person is going to take 18% of your money, then I got to do something. I knew good and well that Uncle Sam wouldn't go for the type of life that I go for. Yeah, the only marriages that I like is Samsonite marriage. I'm sure that you idealists and moralists don't believe in that. Probably don't know about it, but this is where a girl appeals to you, you know, nice looking and all of that, and you just con and get the suitcase and move in. And if she doesn't conduct herself in a temporary manner, then you just pack the suitcase and leave. You don't have to go through that divorce procedure. Well, I knew Uncle Sam wouldn't buy no such stuff as this. And I had acquainted myself with the Michiganda girls, and I didn't like them. Because those girls, they found out that she worked in General Motors, you made good money, and you get that ring in your nose, and some of the nicest places that sold some of the women apparel, they wanted to give a charismatic there. Well, if I'm got to sweat for my money, then the Queen of Sheba can't spend this money. So I wrote an 11-page letter down south to Georgia Peace. And at the climax of that letter, I told this girl that I was in the land of prosperity and the abundance was so great that I couldn't exhaust them for my own needs, and she was the most desirable woman for me to share it with. Well, believe it or not, the next thing that was smoking that left Georgia, she was on it. And on the sixth day, she and I got married. The reason I married that girl so quickly is that I didn't want her to make an investigation and find out who she's marrying to. But you know, while I was out there at General Motors sweating, trying to give her all the luxuries that a poor girl would ever dream of, the girls in the neighborhood educated my wife. And one day, before the year was up, I came home and my wife had gone, and nothing there but three straight chairs. You even moved the wall-to-wall carpet. I never thought the girl had sense enough to leave. And here I am alone, and I ended up in one of the worst conditions I ever ended up in my life. I was committed to the psycho ward here at the hospital as a result of excessive habitual drunkenness. Now, I don't know nothing about love at this point, but I was so twisted up as a result of alcoholism until I knew that my mother and father and two sisters had caused me to be committed to the psycho ward. So I'm going to fix them. Nobody's going to run Charlie's life. So I came out of the psycho ward just as drunk as I was when I went in. I fixed them. But you know, I went up there and I began to analyze this thing. Said, Charlie, are you going to let the bottle be your master? And I knew at that point that I was the greatest person I had ever known. So therefore, I was too smart for to let a drug be my master. So I tried to do some controlled drinking. 9 months later, I found myself in the psycho ward for the second time. I went up there and I thought by this time that maybe I was a couple of bricks of making a full load. So I decided that I would ask for psychiatric counseling. Well, the psychiatrist analyzed me, but he used words I could never understand. I had no intention but to drink again. All of these years, I had tried to become agnostic or atheistic. And somehow or another, and I believe of power greater than myself, the words that my mother used to tell me, you're going to reap what you sow, then things began to ring in my ears. Then I analyzed this. It's an impossibility, Charlie, for you to reap what you sow, because you have sown bad seeds everywhere you have gone, and the oldest man that you ever heard of was Methuselah. And if you have to harvest all these bad seeds, you will live twice as long as he will, you know. So I didn't believe that was possible, so therefore I will not reap what I sow. But she used to say, Charlie, do you worry about anything? See, I was a happy-go-lucky person. And I said, Mother, as long as I got a pocket full of dead presidents, I don't have to worry about anything, you know. I thought money was the answer to all problems. Then I began to watch myself, this chronic insomnia and indefinable fears and all of that. So I said, maybe I should adhere to some of the teachings that my mother dished out there, you know. So the only thing that I know the word about is go down to Buick Sales and buy you one of the biggest Buicks that they make, two-tone white wall tires, hard top, and maybe you can put a value on about approximately $4,000. At that time, I bought that Buick, and I liked it. And I knew that if I get drunk, that'll be a $4,000 drunk. And 14 months later, Charlie is in the Latin Academy for the third time. That car didn't mean nothing. So I went up there, and I knew. I began to do some serious thinking, and I, do you want to die a dreadful death as a drunk? I didn't want to die this way, and I have never entertained the idea of suicide. But out of all of the things that I had tried to get rid of and stay away from, was religion or spiritual way of life, on February 22, 1958, I had exhausted every transitional facility in Genesee County, which Flint is located in Genesee County, and none had helped me. That morning, I said a prayer. And that prayer was something like this. God, give me light whereas I don't stand in my own way. Let me do from morning to night what I must do. and give me clear ideas as to what directions I'm going to take. I was lost. My academic training had taught me something about Socrates. Socrates said, know yourself. I have to go along with my friend, Talbot Hager, who said this, and me and the wife had some literature on Socrates. Socrates didn't do any writing, you know. He been a lot of ill and made a lot of people nervous around the people that But he said, know yourself, and I didn't know me. And I also believe that Plato, in supporting him in writing some of the material, he said that to know yourself, you must be yourself. And I knew that I had been myself. But I think the little carpenter, the 1,972 years ago, that he said, give yourself. And I had nothing to give. Just like I said, I was a horrible example. And anybody pick up from Charlie, he was doomed. I went up there and I decided that something got to be done. I realized that the prodigal son, he had to make a decision before he ever left living with the pigs. And I've been living with the pigs for 22 years. So I had to make a decision. As long as you don't make a decision, you'll stay with the pigs. I went up there and believe it or not, after that prayer, I had some answers. 20 minutes later, the very place that I had fought for many, many years, I told my doctor, this is where I want to go back. I want to always know where I come from. I went there and I was referred to Alcoholic Anonymous. In Alcoholic Anonymous, I didn't want to go. I saw people and I wore out a pair of shoes that night, pacing the floor, the streets one block from the place that they referred me to, trying to make up my mind to go in that AA hall. And the only reason I went in that AA hall is that the therapist told me where to go, and I thought maybe he would have been there to check on me. And I went in there, and one of the greatest things happened to me. There was a man standing up there at that podium, tearing me apart, telling my story. You know, and man, I didn't like being there, and I didn't want nobody to know I was there. And I wouldn't even identify with the man. But nobody knew I'm there until he told that he had spent $52,000 in 1 year for drinking, and everybody knew Charlie was there then. I blurted out, that man got a problem. Anytime he drank $52,000, with me. But you know, the mayor told me that, Charlie, the only difference between you and him is that you didn't have $52,000. And I understood this. You know, that night, first time that I ever been in Texas myself, was that night. They said the Lord's Prayer, and here I am, 88 years old, and I don't know whether I have thy will be done in the right place or no. And when they bowed their head to say the Lord's Prayer, I observed that they were closing their eyes, and approximately 100 people were there, but there was one fellow there who didn't have his eyes closed. I was watching to see who was watching me. And I felt quite embarrassed not to know the Lord's Prayer. Everybody was in harmony, and Charlie don't even know. You know, I was very anxious to get out of that place because I'm going to tell my mother and father that there was a guy that was over the Woodbridge crusading like Billy Graham, had lifted himself out by his bootstrap and was sober and living good. But you know, by the time I made a beeline to that exit there, about 40 people blocked the door and began to show him. Began to shake my hands, and I got very resentful. And the reason I got resentful is it ain't shaking nobody's hands but Charlie, you know, and I don't like that. I don't like to be put on the spot. Well, I didn't want to do my thing there, you know, and so I decided that maybe I would adhere to advice. So I went up there, and they sat me down to a table, and everybody in that building had the privilege of going to the coffee urn, drawing his own coffee, blending in the sugar and cream. All but me, and they had me there just like I was on the surveillance. Charlie, I'll get it for you. Do you want sugar and cream in it? And I didn't like that. But the greatest thing that those people said, that meeting said, Charlie, come back to see us. And this happened to be on a Saturday night. And I went home, and I didn't sleep a wink that night because my mind went back, Charlie, when have you been invited anywhere in the last few years? See, I was a bar reject. I couldn't go nowhere and drink. And I couldn't go to people's houses in the residence that I lived in and have no fun. And the reason I couldn't go to people's houses, you know, this is quite embarrassing when people they have invited you out, you know, and about 3 days later, they come sending a little note to your house, Charlie, if you're going to use my front room for a bathroom, don't come to my house no more. That's embarrassing. So they don't give you a second chance to do that, you know. So I went up there and I didn't want to do my thing that night, and I my mind went back, and I'm going to take advantage of this invitation. And I came back to a closed meeting that Sunday morning, and I found out it was 40 more people, or maybe 50, that had the same identical problem that the guy had the night before that was speaking there. I knew then and there that I had it made. I found out in those closed meetings that it's better to stay sober than it is to get sober. That's hell to get sober. I know. And when this Lillian Ross was talking about it was lost weekend, I lost 22 years. She's just for energy, you know. And I always thought about Paul, you know, when he was in Corinth talking about he had been stoned. Well, hell, if he hadn't been stoned but once, man, I've been stoned for 22 years, you know. So, man, he was an amateur. But I went up there and I knew then and there that I was safe. I was around a group of people who would never throw each other a drink. And if I would only become a part of these people, then I had nothing to worry about. I got with AA and I worked hard. And I stayed with them. I was afraid to leave them. I was afraid to go any place else. The trust that you put in me, I was afraid to lose it. So how do you get sober? Anybody can get sober. But staying sober, that's the main thing. And I think one of the greatest things that ever happened to Alcoholics Anonymous is when they put the 12 suggested steps. I noticed today that we have better than 500,000 people that come in AA, and I'll guarantee you that every one of them works different. You have to find your own program. But I found mine, and the little man that worked with me, he told me how to do it. And from that day to this one, my life has been increasingly better each day that I live. In the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous, it said that we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. I told you at the beginning that it was a pleasure for me to drink when I first started drinking. When I went into service, the pleasure reduced itself and became a price. I gave up many advantages to drink. Scholarships to college and all of this. To drink and do everything that drinking was connected with. And the last 5 years of my drinking, it was painful every time that I thought about drinking. So I have no qualms over being powerless over alcohol. But if your life is becoming unmanageable, my life has been unmanageable ever since I've known Charlie. So how do alcohol fit into it? And I think that alcohol or alcoholism is a byproduct of something else. I was a spoiled brat, and when I drank, I was mortal. So alcohol only magnified and intensified the problem. If I was happy in the beginning, I would never find it necessary to take the first drink. And I think that every drink that I ever had, psychologically, I was unhappy. So I was only acting when I acted as if I was happy. So I got to learn how to organize my life, and I got to learn how to organize it without alcohol. And I do believe that alcoholism, the one that's afflicted with it, if he would put himself on the spot, whereas he would let people give him assistance, then this is what we call self-actualization. Get the best that is out of in you. Get the best that's in you. Nobody's going to do it for you. And the reason I believe this, I come to believe this, I have done many things to improve myself. At the age of 50, I decided to go back to the university. And I went back and I took advanced courses that I had never been to school for. Sociology, political science. I wouldn't take one, I took two. I'm going to work. I'm going to improve myself. Believe it or not, I was telling the wife of the day, I got my mark at the university just the day that I was leaving, coming here. And I got one A and two Bs and about three, honor points there, you know. So, self-actualization is this. How do I feel about me? And I had to get away from the mastery of achievement and go for a level of aspiration. And this is where my happiness comes from. For the first time in my life, I knew what gratitude was that I had to come to believe in something. And I'll tell you, gratitude is the aristocrat to all human emotions. Anytime that a person is grateful, you cannot see no hatred in it. And I know this, I cannot ride the fence. Today I know what love is. Love is a condition in which the other person's happiness is essential to your own. And who would go out there, not even the Catholic, would go out there and get a drunk who's been drunk for 30 days, laying under the tracks and taking to his house, bathing, feeding, giving good clothes, and thinking he's going to a meeting to help himself. No Christian program that I know of, and I happen to be Catholic, so you can't lie to me that they do this. You know, I know. You know, that reminds me of the wife and I was traveling on a plane there this morning, and there was a priest and a Baptist minister and a rabbi on there, you know, and so the students came down and asked the priest, was he ready for his drink? And he said, oh, yes, I'd be delighted to have my drink now. And so he come to the minister, and the minister said, well, are you ready for your drink? And he said, no, I'd rather commit adultery than a drink. And come to the rabbi, and the rabbi said, you know, I didn't know I had a choice. So, when I found out these things, that I must be myself, then I found out that I had to come to believe in AA. The people that had gotten sober was a power greater than me. I didn't know how to get sober, and I didn't know where to start. I wanted to get sober many, many times, so I come to believe in Alcoholics Anonymous and the people that's in it. Now, how did I get sane? And the only way that I could get sane, I joined 3 book clubs, and I bought books of every description that talked about Christianity, religion, and spirituality. And I read everything that Thomas Merton put out. I read just about everything that Bishop Sheen put out, Jock Montaigne, many others. And the thing that I come up with that would improve me is the 4 attributes: honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. And I don't have any of these things, but if I can gain 0.1%, I'm going to automatically be a different person. So this is how I became sane. Then I come down to the 3rd step where it said, made a decision to turn our wills and our lives over to the care of God as we understand. I had to make a decision. The only way I got sober, I had to make a decision. And the only way that I could reorganize my life, I had to make a decision. So I did make a decision. And I have to make a decision not thinking that I'm going to be successful every time. And I used Thomas Edison as a guide. Thomas Edison made more mistakes, but he didn't fail. We had Ty Cobb, made more stolen bases, but he made more attempts too. He made 200 and something attempts to get 96 stolen bases. And this is what Thomas Edison said on a community services council one day when he had to leave his partner there with his project that he was working on and came back. And this project, the partner was pulling his hair out and he wanted to know what was wrong. He said, man, I've tried 30 different ways to make this thing work and the thing, I'm in worse shape now than I was when I started. Naturally, Edison real cool. He said, man, you made a hell of a lot of progress. Say you tried 30 ways, that's 30 ways that won't work, maybe that 31st way will work, you know. Don't give up. So that's the way I see it in Alcoholic Anonymous. I have to make a decision. And anytime I make a mistake, I must realize that it's not a thing. Then it said, turn your life and will over. What is life and will? Life and will is thought and action. My thought is the mother of my act. If I think good, the result's going to be good. If I think bad, the result's going to be bad. And if I don't think nothing, ain't nothing going to happen. So today I know that my thought is the mother of my action. And the evidence of my years around AA has proven this. And the years that I've observed other people has proven this. Then they say, God, as I understand. I understand God today. Every morning that I get up, I say, God, don't you get us into anything that you can't get us out of. I don't look at that fearful God that my mother told me about anymore. He's the same God, but the role that he has planned for me is different. And we have a good time. All but one time since I've been in AA, and this is on my 10th anniversary, and I had worked 3,650 days without a day off. And I went to my God that morning and told him, I said, God, you know that I have worked. And I've worked hard for 3,650 days without a day off. I want the day off. He said, no. He said, Charlie, you must realize you were late getting on the bandwagon. You must keep going. But you know, me and my God have a good time there. And sometimes people question me. I go into work smiling and I hit my card and I'm browsing down the aisle there and people think I'm a nut. But they don't know, boy, we having a good time together. And I just love this thing, you know. And he told me I was free. I don't have to be second to nothing, you know. And I was glad of that because I've been taught the wrong way, you know. Some people say that dogs are our best friends. Some men say that their wife is the best friend. I disagree with it. But I know how come they say it. A dog is your best friend. See, a dog don't give you no advice, and he don't lend you no money, and he don't acquaint you with his in-laws. So that ain't it. And I know that a woman is not my best friend. My wife can come up with some of the craziest things. Just the other day, we was out in the yard digging dandelions there, and some guy crossed the street there, come home, and his wife greeted him on the porch with a great big hug and kiss, you know. And she looked at me and said, Charlie, how come you don't do that? I said, hell, I don't know that woman that well. You know, my wife also is a spendthrift, and she all the time asking crazy questions. One day she went up there and she said, Charlie, what would you do if you was Rockefeller? I said, hell, I never thought of it. I wonder what the hell he would do if he was me. You know, that's it. So you get kind of sharp when you're in AA. So here I do understand, and I think here that I must come to see what is my position in life. And I find that out in step 4. Well, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory ourselves. My inventory is nothing but my mother told me. She told me that when I died and went to the judgment bar that I would see everything that I ever done. Well, I told her, I said, heck, I might as well go straight to hell. I'm no good and well. It's out of balance, you know. So ain't no use to me trying to take the fifth amendment up there, you know. My mother wanted me to be a minister. And she still sang that song, man. My daddy wanted me to be a doctor. Well, I used to doctor on guys when I would get drunk and get down in the ghetto and we'd have an argument, you know. You just get the switchblade and start cutting. You know. And the only thing that was a partial course because he never did no sewing, you know. So I am seeking the best for me. A lot of people want me to be an instructor. And I'm in General Motors, and I make more than instructors. When me and my wife first got married, my wife was a school teacher, and she had more years in teaching than I had in General Motors, and I made twice as much money as she did. Well, what's the use of me going up there with a white collar on? No money. And I seen my family school teachers and didn't have but one suit. One suit, but they talked about that AB degree, that master's degree. You need something other than that. Because I didn't, well, I was a PhD, pilot high and deep, you know. But I did have some hard shepherding moms that couldn't afford them, you know. So, what counts? I don't know, and just like when I first came in AA, and them guys used to think, try to get smart with me, and said, Charlie, you ain't guy behind the ears here. You know, I'm doing a lot of talking. I'm sober now. I've been sober about 4 or 5 days, and I'm getting to sound off. He said, you ain't driving behind the ears yet. I said, hell, that ain't never been my trouble. Didn't drive between the ears. That's my problem. So now I seek the best for me. And I have a good time. I have many programs going on in the shop. I have alcoholism programs. And I happen to talk to some of the high officials like Woodcock and Bluestone, Crazy. And I made him give me money to 12 steps. course, this is not an AA program. I got an alcoholism program in there, and last October I got $12,000 from it. You know, I lose a lot of time out here trying to sober these people up and make good employees out of them. I need some pay for this. So I got a little school going there right in the shop, and I also have 62 Alateen. And you know, the beautiful thing about it, I'm the only black one there. Got 62 Alateens, and I do have one of the best programs, they say. I'm not saying it myself. They say I have one of the best programs working with Alateens that they know of. Been going on 8 years, and we have never missed a meeting. 8 years. And people have said... Two weeks ago, I was in Yankton, South Dakota, and a priest was there. And I told him about how the mothers and fathers took Charlie with their daughters, taking them all up into London, Canada, Adrian, Michigan, Ohio, and all of it, and bringing them back at 2:30 in the morning, and nothing about it. And I said, I know them parents won't even trust the priest that far with them daughters, you know. But they trust Charlie through Alcoholic Anonymous, you know. And I just love it. Sometimes I go there sick, but I'm committed to them. And this is my obligation. I don't want them to get stuck in life like I did. So I'm doing what I can. And I didn't select it this way. They came in. When I first started with Alateens, they had about 5 or 6. And this has grown. These kids take it back to the schools. They take it to the churches. Me and the wife is invited to the colleges and the universities, the churches, and all of that. And even the Nazarene, the Sydney, they invite us over to tell them about alcoholism, what we think about it. You know, and I do believe, you know, if I had to be a Nazarene, I have every reason in the world to drink, you know. But after I have taken the fourth step, I come down to the fifth step, and I don't have to do the fourth step by myself. This is where we admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrong. First, I admit it to God. I'm getting acquainted with God now, and I found out that if I want God to be my friend, I got to be a friend. It can't be a one-sided relationship. So, therefore, we became friends. Then I admit it to myself. The reason I admit it to myself, I found out there's only 3 types of people in the entire world. The first one make things happen, the second one look at things happen, and the third one wonder what happened. Well, I wondered what happened for 22 years. But I found out that if I wanted anything, I had to make it happen. I always wanted a degree in sociology or psychology. I had to make it happen. I had to enroll in the university. They don't go up there and hire guys to be instructors down to Michigan State by saying that I had a dream. God told me that I'm qualified. You know, man, you will forever be looking for a job. You never get it. The reason I believe is that you have to make things happen. My mother used to tell me that if you wanted anything, pray for it. And I got on my knees so many times, I almost come up with chronic rheumatism praying for a Coupe de Ville baby blue convertible Cadillac. Well, you know, after I got sober, I went up there and I told God that if you're going to do it one day at a time, I'm going to make them just like you send them. And I go to work every day. And I got me a Cadillac. I think I owe myself a Cadillac. That's what I want. And I ain't going to lie to you that I'm doing for other people. Man, I enjoy my Cadillac as well as other people just like me having it. Me and the wife have a good time, you know, we travel quite a bit and we never home. So, I had to make this happen. And to show you the difference, if God had given me that Cadillac and seen me to sign that bill there, I did it, all the gratitude been gone. But when you were working for it, paying $168 a month and a few cents, and every time you make a note, 1/36 of that car is yours. Don't belong to the bank. And to show you the difference in the attitude, if God had given me that Cadillac, if it gets dirty and you can't see the color, all you got to do is pray and you get another one. You know, as soon as it went over, you have about 12 Cadillacs out there. But when you're paying $168 a month and it's zero weather and that cold I haven't got on the car, you don't see what color it is. My wife will verify this.
Charlie goes down in the basement and get him a 2.5 gallon pail of warm water and put some Tide in it and baptizes it in zero weather, you know.
And every time you see the color, that's gratitude, you know. So I have a grateful moment at least 36 times, you know. So I had to make this happen. Then to another human being. I think one of the greatest problems, this reason I told you about my contact with Woodcock, communication. And I was just reading the other day, we have about 79 astronauts. And I want to look at the wonderful communication going to the moon and while they're up on the moon, they're communicating with each other. Everything's getting along fine. Well, do you know 15% of those astronauts have divorced? Can't even get along at home. And I'm sure if they communicated like they did on the moon, they wouldn't have no difficulty leaving their child, their children and their wives and all of that. So communication is our survival. I think when they told us the language of the heart, this was the thing that got me to come back. I wasn't able to learn too much intelligence when I come in, but I think the language of the heart is the thing that brought me back to AA. These people talk a different way than other people. Then, to learn to communicate, you've got to learn to talk with people. And I think our third concept tells us every person is entitled to a right of decision. Man, and if you don't believe it, you just come to my house sometime and you must, if you're going to keep the war down, you must give them women the right of their opinion. They ain't going to change, you know. So therefore, I have learned this. My wife just ain't going to do things right, so who get tore up over? You know, I used to preach sermons. You know, if you would do it this way, it would be all right. And after I had preached an hour and a half, I said, how do you feel about that? Didn't I make a good outline? She said, my decision is the same as it was before you started. You know? So I found out I was wasting time. So I must give them a right of decision. Then I come down to minimizing things. This is where we come down to we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defective characters. The main thing, what is a defective character? A defective character is an unresolved discontentment. When I hate, you can get all the books off the shelf and it won't do no good. My mind is corrupt and the wheels are spinning and they don't have time for nothing to come in. So this is a character defect. You are not being yourself. You know, and I tell the wife about this all the time. I still take inventory and I have every right in the world to take inventory. My wife, she just go down and patternize those Jews, and I tell her, I say, honey, as long as you patternize those Jews, they will always beat them Arabs, because they're going to be riding Cadillac, and them Arabs will be riding camels. You know? But, don't think you're no good. And I say, honey, them clothes ain't going to change you in the first place. What you really need is go to a plastic surgeon. You know, that's the only thing. But, she does it her way, and she seems to be satisfied. And not only the thing that satisfies her, don't satisfy me. So I got to know what a character defect is. And then I come down to shortcomings. Humbly ask him to remove out a shortcoming. First thing got me here is humble. What is humility? Humility is the ability to accept yourself as you really are. And I'm sure that most women don't like themselves. That's the reason I left and come downstairs early today and left my wife up there. She don't want to be herself, you know, and she comes around and wants to look like a figure eight. And when she takes that paycheck off, man, she's a very big blue that mean AA is loose, you know. And when I found out how all these dances come about, man, my wife's got a girdle there about 3 sizes too little, and she's just up there trying to, you know, I'm glad it is a loose program, not one of those real. So I have to be me. I'll never be nobody but me. And if any of you read Psychotype Next by Maxwell Maltz, you'll find. Tell you, I've known some of the most beautiful people that have plastic surgery, and their attitude was still rotten. Didn't change that between the ears, not one bit. So I must condition myself to be me. Then it says something about shortcoming. What is a shortcoming? A shortcoming is not living up to a reasonable expectation. This is when I went back to school, and many people in AA said, Charlie, it's going to be fatal.
Well, I know now from psychology, being practicing to be an experimental psychologist, I know now how come they said it. And I don't argue with it. The only reason a person tells me it's going to be fatal, I have done something that he ain't got enough guts to do. Everybody would like to improve himself, but he ain't got enough guts. He got too many fears, all swamped up in fear. So therefore, anybody that does anything, then he says something in business to him, you know. So I know this now. And I know how to keep my mouth shut for the first time in my life. I found out that that red piece of flannel will start many wars, you know. So I learned to keep my mouth shut, you know, and just use my stress tolerance. Then I come down to amends, and I would put the two amends together. And I think the safeguard is in the ninth step when it said, make amends, except when the people were in his room or other. Amends mean change. Amends and said nothing about apologizing. And I guarantee you, I have seen, and my wife can verify this, where men have apologized for things that they did 12 years ago, and they haven't had the privilege of living under the same roof that the wife and three kids are. Man, we said, let sleeping dogs lie. You wake them up, you'll get bit. That my wife don't know, I will never expose. You know. And I was looking at all of the farmland out here, and you see big piles of manure that have been there all the winter. And you can trespass, and you don't get no smell. But if you go in that barn and get that pick and shovel and start digging, you're going to get a smell. We said, let things stay as they are, you know. And my wife has better sense to ask me, Charlie, that night you stayed away for 4 days. Where were you? I said, honey, if we don't get any good out of it, I'll tell you. But if we ain't going to get no good about it, we ain't talking. So she don't say no more. I don't expose nothing that she don't already know, you know. Then I come down to the 10th step, and it says continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admit it. I guarantee you, when something goes wrong, do something bad. I know. It's just like weeds or dandelions. We got bad dandelions around Flint. And them sun are going to grow without even being cultivated. Man, the next one, man, you dandelion high in the grass, you know. I didn't plant no dandelions out there. But you know, I think it's good. It keeps you busy. And it reminds me of the time when a man didn't have nothing, he was destitute, and some man happened to be charitable and give him 1 acre of land. He gave him 1 acre of land with nothing but weeds out there, and as he saw it through, but as he began to clean the thing up, he found one rose bush. And he began to break them off at the joint, he began to root them. In a few years, he had the prettiest rose garden in that community. And then some tourists came around one day and told him that God has been real wonderful to you. You got one of the prettiest flower gardens in this community. He said, don't tell that lie. You ought to see what a mess it was when he had it. You know, I did. You know, so I don't want to get so big that, you know, I think that God don't have some part to do with my life. So therefore, he has endowed me with the ability to control myself. Any time that I lose control, then I'm not being me. So I have to correct things. I have to get these weeds out. You know, if I don't get them out, they're going to choke the thing that I planted there that was good. Then I come down to the 11th step where it says, thought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. I did speak. I'm still speaking. Me and my wife continue to speak. And as we continue to speak, our lives become closer and closer. And people become closer to us. Man, that phone at my house just rings all the time. If it ain't the wife, it's me. And luckily, something against the heart of AA, most of the people that call me is girls. They think I'm a psychologist. I ain't got my degree yet. But we have a good time. We don't have no criticism toward our action. We don't question. Where were you the last couple of hours? You were supposed to get off at 2 o'clock. We don't question each other. And she will verify this. And we get along fine. And it has to stay like this. So we continue to seek to find better methods to improve ourselves. We do this to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand. We don't question. My wife is a churchgoer. She pays her tithes. I don't. The reason I don't, I happen to be Catholic, and I don't like confession.
And I've said ever since I became a Catholic that honest confession is good for the soul, but it's bad for the reputation, too. So therefore, Pope Paul can't change me, and he ain't going to have nothing to do with me going to heaven or hell in the first place. That's what I have done, whether I'm going either place, you know. But I've always said, if heaven's going to have my mother there, that would be hell for me in the first place, you know. So you can't do nothing right for her, you know. So I do things to improve my conscious contact, not to satisfy somebody else's conscience. So therefore I'm satisfied this week. I have no sleepless night that I didn't do the right thing today. I've satisfied my own conscience and I sleep like a baby. And I try to get the wife to take the fifth step with me. She just jumps and talks in her sleep and taking all kind of Libyans and Byron and all that, you know. I said, honey, all you got to do, you be cute if you just take the fifth step with me, you know, that's all. She ain't got enough guts. I say she wants to, but she ain't got enough guts. Then I come down to the wonderful 12th step. After having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, we try to carry the message to the alcoholic and practice these principles in all our affairs. Spiritual experience, my only spiritual experience was when I decided that I would do something about my life and put myself on the spot and be obedient to the rest. Do the things that I think is right. Then, the alcoholic, carried the message of the alcoholic. Me and the wife like better things since I'm sober, you know, and we bought some wall-to-wall carpet, $18 a square yard, and I don't puke on that, and I am not giving nobody first power over me to puke on. So I don't bring no drunks to the house. We got too many 12-step houses there, and I'll meet you at your home, or we'll go to a focal point, and we'll talk there. My wife gets drunk in the first place. I think the last 7 words, now that's not to take a few minutes on the last 7 words. I have many, many things to be proud of. Many things that would not have come about if it hadn't been for Alcoholics Anonymous and me being obedient to the direction that Alcoholics Anonymous had set forth before I got here. First, I happen to be the second black delegate to ever go to New York American World Conference. I don't say that braggingly, but it was people like you. It wasn't but 2 black books that got me there, and you got to go for 2 series. And people like you showed that you love me by sending me to New York, carrying the message, bringing the message back. I happened to share with Bill W. and some of the trustees that's present here today when he had his last document by having the first world conference in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And fortunately, I was in the Roosevelt Hotel just proud to be there. I don't know too much of what went on for those 5.5 days. But on the 50th day, 2 delegates to represent the United States and Canada, and I happen to be one of the delegates. As a result of practicing principles, I'm not a smart guy. And there's a little girl up there, we're about 30 pounds, had to show me everything I supposed to do, you know. But as a result of practicing the principles, I'm with the biggest foundation. I happen to be a board of directors, one of the biggest foundations in the world, the Mark Foundation in Flint. I don't know what my job is, but they said that you have done a wonderful job in staying sober, so we want you to be a board of directors. And many things have happened to me. And I think one of the highlights of the things that happened to me today, and I'm real proud of it, that my wife loves me today, and I don't blame her one bit. Ladies and gentlemen, I see the green light is on. And I know today, after being around, going on my 15th year, that the mind can only absorb as much as the back end can endure. So I would say, for the people just coming in or acting as recruits, be like a banana. Stick to the bunch. If you get away from the bunch, you're going to really get fear. I like to close this with a prayer. God of our weary years, God of our silent tears, Thou who has brought us thus far on our way, God with all Thy might has led us into the light. Help us, O God, we pray. Let our feet stray from the path, O God, where we met Thee. Let our hearts drunken of the wine of the world, we forget Thee. Shattered beneath Thy hand, may we forever stand, true to our God, true to our fellow man.